Hold hands and close your eyes. It's 12:30, and you're listening to the Ghost Story Pass. Welcome to the Ghost Story, guys. I'm Brennan Storr.
I'm Ian Gibbs.
And this is a show where we talk about spooks, specters, and all the other things watching us from the shadows beyond the campfire. Some conversations only make sense after the sun is set, and this is most definitely one. Thanks for tuning in. It's Tuesday, May 2nd. This is Episode 8, and we're coming to you from that tiny mountain cabin you dream about but can never quite reach. How you doing, Ian?
I'm doing well. I'm feeling a lot better than I was.
You look a lot better.
Yeah, well, I'm getting sleep and don't feel like I'm trapped in an iron lung, so that's very helpful.
You started doing interviews for your book now.
I did. It's all very real. I've done an interview on CBC, which is a big deal here in Canada, and I did one on French Canadian radio, and they called me and said, would you do this? And I'm like, I don't speak French. Apparently, I could do it in English and we're all good. And then a local radio station here, CFAX, is kind of a news talk radio. I did 40 minutes on there.
Wow.
Yeah, it seemed to go pretty well.
No, I heard that. It was, I liked that part where you told the story about the ghost.
You didn't listen.
I did. You were great. That lady had great questions.
It was a man. His name was Ryan, and you're a dick. I'm feeling better, but you look worse. What's going on? You look all kind of Frankenstein-y.
Oh, yeah. I hurt myself at the gym. I was doing these dumbbell rows and
figures.
That's one dad joke. That's all you get.
Oh, Jesus.
I know.
Full quota.
Be a lot of editing this episode. I was doing these dumbbell rows and I just had my head turned a little bit to the side. And it was 105-pound dumbbell, so it's you have to pay attention while you're lifting that kind of weight.
For sure.
And I was being an idiot, not really paying attention to what my body was doing. And I just felt this tweak in my neck. And I immediately dropped the weight and went.
Yeah.
And I stood up and I walked around and I couldn't turn my head at all to the right.
Wow.
I could turn it about, I don't know, maybe 15 degrees to the left. And I thought, oh, man, I've crippled myself.
You know, and how are you going to drive home?
Well, that's exactly it. How the hell am I going to drive home? Because this is 11:30 at night.
Right.
And my gym is, you know, a 10-minute drive from my house.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was wandering around looking like a forlorn child.
You know, giant forlorn child.
It's a pituitary condition.
Yeah.
Don't you feel bad now?
Mommy feeds me love.
No, that sounds. Don't ever say that again.
I meant pizza.
But oh, sorry. Trying to recover. Bring it back to center. Ooh. And scene. Yeah, finally, I managed to stretch it out enough. I could turn my head, you know, enough to the right. To you know, shoulder check mostly.
Yeah.
And thankfully it's 11:39 Victoria. There's no one around anyways.
That's right.
But yeah, no, it was a real drag. And I have this sort of this long history of doing this to myself. You know, like year before last or no, last year, I was double shifting, going to the gym a lot, you know. And my body started doing this thing where I was so tired I would just turn off.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I'd never known that was possible. I would just, I'd
like
be
power down.
Oh yeah.
And what did, like what would happen? You just fall asleep? Or
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I would be, there was one time I was about to do the bench press. I was lying back on the bench and I thought, oh, I feel funny. And I just had my arms on the bar and I thought, maybe not just yet because something doesn't feel, and I just dozed off just for a second.
Holy cat.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like narcolepsy.
Pretty much. Yeah. 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 It was not fun. I mean, I got the best sleep of my life. But,
yeah, I bet.
But on the bench at the gym.
Yeah. And then they asked you to leave and it was all uncomfortable.
Yeah. I started masturbating.
You woke up with an AED attached to your chest.
That's right.
They just assumed.
But so I go into the gym and I just done my personal record for leg press, which was 900 pounds.
Right.
I was very impressed with myself.
And how did you end up weighing 900 pounds? Was that like a conscious choice or were you living in a trailer?
Well, I was on a TV show for TLC. And then you know, I lost the weight actually by playing this game called Hide and Go F*** Yourself.
I don't know that game.
Well, not what I hear. Not what I hear. Anyways, yeah, I did a single rep of that again, feeling very happy with myself.
Yeah.
But then I saw some guy do 1,100 and I thought, okay, never mind.
What a bastard.
Yeah, right?
I hope you ran him over with your car while you couldn't see.
That's right.
Blame it on your neck. I didn't see him.
I crapped in his gym bag. Left notes that Ian Gibbs did this.
And a copy of my book.
That's right.
Hey, whatever gets it out there.
I also left my number and said, read it, tell me what it's like.
Give me 5 salient points.
That's right.
I can work into a conversation.
Anyways, I went to go do it again another day, and I was so tired I wasn't paying attention. And it's a one rep max for a reason.
Right.
I drifted, and I did it twice. And I did it a third time, and then I just felt something go tweak in my knee.
No.
Yeah, so I still am coming back from that. Was a year, a little over a year ago now. I'm still kind of coming back from that. I can lift about, well, it doesn't matter. I'm getting back up there. It's just I think my days of 900-pound leg lifts are over. My old man knees are not going to do it. And then now that I've, you know, crippled myself again.
Yes.
I can't even, it's better than it was, thank God.
Yeah.
But I still can't turn to the left without moving my entire upper body. I look like Michael Keaton in the first Batman movie.
So the limbo contest, we're not doing that now?
The limbo contest is officially canceled.
Okay, good to know.
It would have been anyways, but this is a better reason.
Yeah, I agree.
So moving on from our aging mortal husks to something far more interesting. We have another guest this week.
We do, and on a really interesting subject too. It was an interesting read.
Yeah, our guest this week is Lloyd Auerbach, author of Psychic Dreaming. This is a re-release of a book that Lloyd originally published in 1991. And he was a really fascinating guy, very generous with his time.
Nice.
And we're going to cut to that now. So when we come back from the break, you'll hear Lloyd Auerbach. And when you come back after that, you'll be back in our loving arms.
Yay!
Well, I killed the mood. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Ghost Story, guys. I'm here with our guest, renowned paranormal expert and parapsychologist Lloyd Auerbach. Lloyd is on the board of directors for the Ryan Research Center and since 2013 has been the president of the Forever Family Foundation, an organization supporting research on life after death and the work of spirit mediums in the grieving process. He has authored and co-authored a total of 9 books on the subject of the paranormal and is here today to talk to us about the revised edition of his 1991 bestseller Psychic Dreaming, now available from Llewellyn. Thanks for being here with us, Lloyd.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So I'm really curious. You've been professionally involved with the world of the paranormal for a very long time now, decades. Do you mind telling me a little bit about what put you on that path?
Well, you know, it's really been an interest since I was a little kid. I mean, literally since I was a little kid. I was very, very much a TV baby. My dad worked for NBC and I had a TV set in my room when I was 2. I was watching, even early on, watching The Twilight Zone and One Step Beyond and Popper and other things that had a paranormal theme to them, and got into reading comic books and science fiction. And that just simply combined with my interest in science, I discovered that there actually was a field of science called parapsychology. I discovered that very, very young and had teachers who encouraged me in high school, and it just kind of coalesced, came together, and timing-wise, just put me on the path. But it was not because of any sort of psychic experience. It was partly because this was kind of the human superpowers, and that's the science, the comic book and science fiction thing.
Of course. And I guess that leads to a question I was going to speak about later, but I am curious. Do you think this kind of thing, for example, I hesitate to say psychic powers, but we'll say psychic sensitivity, do you think that's something that is innate or something that can be trained?
We can bring it out. I mean, everybody is a little bit psychic, especially as kids, and it's just a matter sometimes of finding out what you're good at psychically. I certainly have had psychic experiences, and I've had ways that I can kind of bring it out for myself from time to time. I just haven't really focused on that because my interest has been kind of outside that, looking at what's going on as opposed to having the experiences all the time myself. But it is something we can really, once we figure out what kind of experiences we have and where our talents kind of lie, it's kind of like figuring out your musical talent or artistic ability. You got to figure out what you're good at, and then you can really bring it out at that point.
I find that very interesting because it seems as though many people in this field are chasing that veridical experience, which will show to them that it's all real. And so it's fascinating for me to hear from someone who is not particularly concerned with that necessarily. They're not looking for that personal experience.
Yeah, you know, most people in the field of parapsychology did not get into it because of a personal experience. We're all very just curious about the frontiers of human experience, but also about human potential, because what these experiences say, beside the fact that they're not being looked at by mainstream science, which leaves this huge hole in understanding humanity, but they say that there's a lot more to human beings than what mainstream science seems to think. And this is an area that question really kind of drives a lot of us for looking at what's going on. I mean, having an experience doesn't hurt, but it's a rare person who gets into the field because of their experiences.
So on that subject, early on in the book, you describe research into size having stagnated around the time you wrote, which was, of course, in the around 1990, 1991. Can you help me understand what you mean by psi exactly? And then I'm curious to know whether that has changed, whether we have improved our game as far as our research into the scientific aspects of what we call the paranormal.
Sure. Well, psi is the 23rd letter of the Greek alphabet. It was chosen by J.B. Rhine back in the 1930s. He started the first big American parapsychology laboratory, which continues as the Rhine Research Center today. But it was chosen because it represents psyche or the mind, and it was used as kind of a generic or non-emotional, non-charged, non-baggage term to cover extrasensory perception and psychokinesis. But also to cover anything related to those experiences and to consciousness experiences where we're connecting with things outside our body, or even the idea of consciousness surviving the death of the body, which was where you get to ghosts and reincarnation and things like that. So those are all psi phenomena or psi experiences. Research in psi, when it hasn't increased, unfortunately, across the boards in the U.S. or even around the world, with the exception perhaps of places like Brazil, because there have been more and more people getting involved in scientific research down there. It's a lot more open academically to do that. The problem in the U.S. is our academics are incredibly prejudiced.
Prejudiced against the possibility of...
They're not even open to the possibility. And part of that's the academic climate, and a part of that is thanks to the organized skeptics movement, PSYCOP, the predecessor of the Center for Scientific Inquiry today, but the skeptics movement over since the 70s has made it unfriendly for any academic to even admit that they're interested in this, let alone that they might want to do research in it.
My assumption had been that it was perhaps a growing evangelical sentiment that was behind that. So it's fascinating for me that skepticism is actually the thing stagnating development.
Yeah,
there.
I don't think any of us have really seen that it's been the religious movement in any way, shape, or form, except maybe on an individual basis with psychics and certain individuals, but it certainly has not affected or impacted research at all. It's been the skeptics.
That is so interesting. Skepticism stifling intellectual development seems counterproductive somehow. But
you know, a few years ago, I think it was 2011, Daryl Bem published an article in the Journal of Personality Studies, which is a major psychology journal. The upcoming journal issue was announced, and his article, which was on a precognition study done over a 2-year period at Cornell University, when that was announced that was going to be in the journal, there was this incredible hue and cry across mainstream science, pretty much, you know, yelling at the journal, how dare you even consider publishing something like this? And it was from people in a variety of areas of science. Some of them were very big names. And it was interesting, if you looked at the interview, some of the reporters actually asked the question, have you read the study? And the response was typically, why would I?
Oh, boy.
And that's about as unscientific. I mean, they didn't even know that whether Daryl had positive or negative results.
I subscribe to a number of atheist podcasts. I've seen that attitude, and it's fascinating how they will so quickly refute a study or a claim without any evidence, or really with only superficial evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, I mean, they don't read any, they will not read any of the mainstream folks generally won't read any of our journal articles. And when they do, there are a few who have been cajoled into it or talked into it by some of my colleagues like Ed May. And when they do, they're shocked at how quality oriented our research is, how well controlled it is. And they still don't necessarily agree with the outcome in terms of the interpretation of the results, but they don't quibble about the actual results. So it's really about a preconceived prejudice, a bias that people have, which frankly is as dogmatic and fundamentalist in science as it is on the religious side.
The work that you do with the Rhine Research Center, is that sort of, I suppose that exists in spite of this prevailing climate. Are you working on research into psi still?
Yeah, there is some research that goes on at the Rhine Center. They have a couple projects. One is a kind of bioenergy lab where they're looking at biophotons. We give off very, very few photons of light from our brains, from our heads. And they are detectable in the right conditions. And they're working with healers and martial artists and some other folks to see if they can, while they're doing their thing, whether they're producing an increase in biophoton emission. And so far, the indication is they can. So that's a really interesting thing. They're also doing some other ESP research and looking at a project long-term in out-of-body experiences as well. But the Ryan Center is as much an educational center as anything else. They're kind of a resource for a lot of folks. They sponsor a number of lectures that have been going on for several years, and there is video and audio in the media library, which people can get if they join the organization. And we have an education center, which offers online courses. So, for example, on May 10th, I think I'm doing the first of the live webinars for an Introduction to Parapsychology course. It's an 8-week course. People can listen live, or they can actually just watch the recordings. So we have students all over the world in different time zones. So it's just we offer a lot of different things. And the funding for the Ryan Center has been terrible. I mean, the funding for a couple of the research projects has been good, but the funding for parapsychology is almost non-existent. And the Ryan Center is constantly struggling. They've had to kind of cut down back on the number of personnel in terms of their hours and such. And at the moment, since I'm on the board of directors decided to try something brand new, which is we have a project called Psychics for Psychic Research. And we have a GoFundMe campaign to come up with the seed money so that we can bring in some of the top remote viewers to do a fundraising project where they're going to use their associative remote viewing for investment. There have been very successful projects in the past on that have done very well. And so we're trying to do it now with the Ryan Center. We have a little bit of seed money ourselves, but we're trying to raise some through the GoFundMe campaign as well. There's also a raffle that the Ryan Center is doing, which has got a couple of really great prizes. In fact, I got to pick up a ticket myself. I think I can find out about that because there's one I'm just looking at it right now. There's a week for two at a house in the heart of the wine country in Tuscany, Italy, and then a weekend in West Palm Beach, and then readings from psychics and a whole bunch of other things too. So yeah, they've had some donations of some hard things, not cash per se.
Right.
But they're all going to support the Ryan Center.
I am curious, who is considered a leading remote viewer right now?
One of our board members is Joseph McMonagle.
Oh, okay.
Joe McMonagle. Yeah, Joe was, of course, the Army's number one viewer for the Stargate program. But Paul Smith has also been connected, has also taught a course for the Ryan Center as well. So
I believe it was McMonagle who described in an interview that he was told by someone in one of the overseeing bodies that he was doing the devil's work.
I mean, that happens from time to time.
Yeah.
I think politics is the devil's work anyway. So. Pot calling the kettle black.
So true. All right. So moving on to the book, I'm curious. So, of course, Psychic Dreaming was originally released in 1991. Why have you chosen now to release a revised edition?
Well, the timing was right for a couple of my older books, which have been out of print. Had a lot of people interested in them. And Llewellyn Publishing got really interested in that particular book, so we revised the book for them specifically. And it's a topic. I've already co-taught a course on dreams and altered states at the Ryan Center, and there's a couple courses we have coming up, one by me and one by someone else over the next year in this. And people more and more just are talking about their psychic dreams. And of course, we had some really interesting things happen around 9/11 and even before that.
Right. Has there been any other indications of psychic dreaming associated with more modern, say, disasters, like a recent election, for example, or any other horrific event that's changed the way the world operates?
Well, one of the things that has to happen is people have to write in their dreams. They have to send them in. And the Ryan Center and a few other places have been getting reports of those things. And there's still some analysis going on. You know, one of the problems, however, is that people will have dreams of the world going to hell at this point in time, you know, not literally, but because of climate of fear that's been generated in and around the media and in politics, it's hard to separate sometimes out the just pure emotional reaction dreams from ones that are psychic. So one of the things that we consider when people have these dreams and they write them in or talk to folks in my field about them is how did you know that this was a psychic dream? And if they talk about the content versus the feeling, then we know it's probably not a psychic dream unless they can be very specific in what's coming up. For the most part, it's really interesting. People who have had psychic dreams, whether they were of disasters or just really mundane stuff, because most people have psychic dreams, precognitive dreams that are very mundane. They have nothing to do with anything major, even in their lives. And it might just be that they're going to go to work the next day and their boss is going to be wearing this new tie that they've never seen before. And lo and behold, there's that tie on their boss. So that's about it. That's the extent of the entire precognitive dream. So not emotional, not exciting, just those are the kind of normal things. But what's different about these dreams is what people that I've interviewed and others have interviewed is that the dream, when they woke up, the dream felt different. It seemed different. It was realer than real. I mean, those are things that we hear about here all the time. And I've talked to people who've had dreams of you know, issues politically and otherwise, and they don't have that sense. The dream was about something negative going to happen, but they had no sense that it was any different than any other dream.
Right. I understand that there's no sense that the dream is the same way. Not special, right. I understand. Yeah. I've had dreams like that where you wake up and you think that wasn't just a dream. That dream has a very particular power.
Right. Exactly.
Fascinating. So I'm actually really curious about that because I know in the chapter Dreams of Days Past, you touch on reliving past life experiences through dreams with an eye toward learning lessons from them. And I was just curious, and of course, this ties into what you're saying, how do people tease apart these dreams from other dreams? You know, that say, is it the same thing? Is there a sense that this is more, or is there a more definite way to mark that difference?
Well, probably with the reincarnation or past life dreams, those are probably the most difficult to determine or have any sort of sense of reality or in actuality relate to an actual past life. Partly because the past life story, the story of you being a pirate, and the dream doesn't have like a flashing, this is your past life at the top of it.
Of course.
Yeah, you just dream about being a pirate or you dream about being someone in colonial America or something like that. And the problem here is it may feel impactful, but again, you have to ask whether it felt realer than real. That's number one. Whether it had any metaphor in it, because generally psychic dreams have less metaphor than others, even though they may not have complete pictures. And finally, whether the dream was actually of a past life or not, it probably is telling you something about from your unconscious. And when people are regressed in hypnosis, in parapsychology, we don't consider hypnotic regression a good tool for finding out information about past lives at all. Because the very suggestion by the hypnotist that you've had a past life will cause you to have a past life creation. Your unconscious will create one. And it often reflects some issues going on in your life. So it's great therapeutically, but from a verifiable perspective, it's not so good. That's why when we're doing research with reincarnation, we tend in the field to work with kids who are not exposed to other information. They're like 2-3 years old. They're extensively remembering past lives, some of which can actually lead to addresses, names, very, very specific information.
It's interesting for me to hear that this is also happening in Western culture, because typically when I read about past life cases, it's in places where past lives are considered they're more culturally accepted, say, for example, in India. So this is definitely something that's happening in the West.
It is. We probably don't get as many case reports as we possibly could. And in fact, it's likely that some of those cases we hear about in the news where a child was exorcised or had, some demon hunter sort of ritual on them.
Right.
And sometimes they end up getting hurt seriously. The kid might have actually been talking about a past life and might have had nothing to do with possession whatsoever. There's also the issue of parents not wanting their kids to possibly talk about them, because if the kid talks about it in school, given that it's not that accepted, the child may be seen as kind of an outcast, weird, strange, or kind of targeted by bullies. So there are some real cultural downplays here. However, there's some really good cases. There was the one with the Leininger family in the book Soul Survivor, and this was a kid who remembered being a World War II pilot and had so much information that his father, who was a fundamentalist Christian, really followed up on it. I mean, got to give him a lot of credit for paying attention because of the information that was there and really following it to its conclusion.
So are we any closer to understanding the mechanisms of how these things work, precognitive dreams, reincarnation? I mean, I assume not, given that the research hasn't progressed.
Yeah, we're actually not, we're not any really closer to understanding the mechanism of dreaming. And we're not even closer to understanding or coming to a consensus on what consciousness is in science. it's a huge debate in science, whether or not consciousness is just a matter of programming in the brain, whether it's something different. There are constantly new definitions that come out, and some of them point to consciousness possibly existing outside the body or after death, and some of them basically are programming, so we're just kind of like meat robots. And it's really hard for us to progress beyond a certain point, other than understanding what makes a person more psychic or why a person might have more of these dreams than someone else. And even there, we're kind of bound into the dream recall thing. How many people are actually having psychic dreams and not remembering them or not writing them down or not keeping track of them?
Right. So what would an indicator be of why someone, or a reason rather, why someone would be having those experiences versus someone who's not having those experiences?
Well, we find typically that people who are creative, who have access to kind of creative flow in one way, shape, or other, tend to be more psychic than others, partly because they don't second guess themselves. And you can be creative in science. You can actually be creative in accounting, of course, if you want to go that way. But creativity tests kind of go side by side with psychic ability. And so people who are in the creative arts, whether it's writing, art, or music, tend to be more psychic than non-creative people or people who aren't accessing that. We also find that there's a new correlation that seems to be showing up, and we're really trying to look at that. And this is an area where there is some new research in it, with something called synesthesia, which is a perceptual cross-wiring of the senses. So you are seeing smells and you're hearing tastes. So there's kind of a partial crosswiring or complete crosswiring. It's something people used to report all the time with LSD, also, that you get a synesthesia experience. And about 4% of the population has some form of synesthesia. And it seems, at least from what we're looking at, that people who are very psychic may be in that 4% group. So we're looking at that also. There's other research that's going on. We are looking at research with mediums, spirit mediums, and finding that their brain activity is different when they are conversing with spirits versus doing a psychic reading versus having a conversation with a researcher.
What method are you using to assess the brain activity?
They're doing both EEG and fMRI.
Oh, okay. Going back to the book, in the chapter Dreams of the Here and Now, you describe the potential pitfalls of precognitive dreams, particularly when you try to use them to prevent crimes from taking place, as an example. Can you elaborate a bit on that? And have you ever seen cases where that's happened, where someone has had a veridical dream of a crime that they have brought to authorities and implicated themselves?
Yeah, actually, there was a woman a number of years ago, I believe it was back in the 80s, who she was a nurse, and she had a dream of a woman going off an embankment. I believe it was in Colorado, and she ended up helping them find the body because of her dreams. Called them, told them she was arrested, and ended up going to trial. And there was actually no connection between her and the individual who was killed. So, it ended up being a murder case. So we see this on TV sometimes, you know, that psychics, the phony psychic who goes into the police to try to get their reputation turns out to be a phony psychic, and they're the killer. They wanted to be close to the case. That doesn't really happen in real life. But fortunately, most people who call in their dreams or call in their psychic impressions I don't know if it's fortunately or unfortunately, they usually get ignored. And it's the rarest case. That was absolutely a case where the police either were not interested in finding someone else, or there was something corrupt going on in the police department at that point.
Talk about no good deed going unpunished. And just the thought of that puts me, I'm not that I ever have psychic dreams, but I've spoken to people who have gone to the police with what they believe is the location of a particular body. They've gone and said, I think it's here. And I thought, man, if you're right, you're going to have some questions to answer.
Yeah. And, you know, I think as long as people know that they're going to have to answer some questions, it's okay. I've worked with psychics. One of my co-authors, Annette Martin, the late Annette Martin, used to work with police regularly for a couple decades. And the first time she went in, because she said she thought she knew where a body was, she fortunately met with a police detective, a homicide detective, who did check her out. I mean, he didn't like grill her or anything, but she led to the body. He did check her out to make sure there was no connection between her and the person whatsoever they could find. And they were able to find the culprit also. So it partly depends on the police officers themselves. You know, if a person witnesses an event like where somebody digging and dropping a body into the hole in the ground, but it was too dark and they didn't see what the figure is, that person's still under suspicion that they might have been the killer themselves.
Right.
So even with actually physically witnessing things, the police may still think you're a suspect or a person of interest until they can figure out that you're not. So that's important to know. The other thing is that sometimes the police can't act on information like that, partly because of public outcry. You know, if it's they're at a point where they're at the end of their rope, so to speak, they'll pretty much act on almost anything. But the average psychic who has an impression, whether it's a dream impression of something or an actual impression of it, without any sort of track record with that police department offering their services, is probably going to be ignored by most police departments, partly because the police are often afraid that that person will want to use that one case, even if they're right, to kind of boost a reputation that they might hear back from the public, both the religious right and the other side, that, you know, they're wasting public funds. That comes up quite a bit.
Right. I guess since we've already broached the subject of remote viewing and now we're talking about the police, I'm curious, is that something that police are open to? Obviously we've discussed cases where they've listened to someone calling in, but I know when I was listening to, say, Noreen Renier talk or Pam Coronado, she appears to do this kind of work. I'm surprised that that is happening. So is that happening and how often?
I don't know about how often. I don't know if there are any stats right now, but there are psychics who have worked, like Noreen, who have worked with police for a long time, and Pam. Nancy Meyer, who's in Pennsylvania, has a good track record, like I said, Annette Martin used to when she was alive. It just depends on whether or not they find a police officer up front or can support the police in a way that is not hampering the investigation. I mean, that's really the biggest issue, is what they're doing going to hamper the investigation? There's a book, it's unfortunately out of print these days, called The Blue Sense by Arthur Lyon and my late colleague Marcello Truzzi. Truzzi was a skeptic in terms of a true skeptic, a middle-of-the-roader. He really looked at both sides of the question. He looked at the research. He found extreme usefulness in many police psychics or psychics who were police, and he didn't believe in ESP. His opinion was that these people were wired differently, so then when they looked at the evidence, they saw something different in it, kind of like some of the quirky TV detectives like Monk.
Right.
So his feeling was, okay, let them call themselves psychic. They're still useful. If they're useful, use them. If they're not useful, don't use them, regardless of how psychic they might or might not be. And that's really the best way to look at it. If you can find someone who is useful and work within their framework, that's the way to go.
Absolutely. And I guess that gets us past the point of labels, which is, you know, you wonder if you can avoid the label psychic, how much less inflammatory the use of that person would be.
It's got a lot of baggage to it, unfortunately. When I first got into the field, actually after grad school, I worked at the American Society for Psychical Research in New York. And one of our research subjects, Alex Tanis, who was a well-known psychic on one level, but really not that well-known compared to him, because he didn't really seek fame. But within the field, he was incredibly well-known. And Alex, whenever he was down from Maine, because he flew himself down from Maine every couple of weeks for a week's worth of research, we had someone from NYPD or Boston PD or FBI or all three or some other police department coming to meet with him during that week. And I can't tell you, I mean, there was never a week that I was working there that Alex was down, that someone from law enforcement wasn't coming to consult with him. And none of the cases Alex worked on revealed later on, because they asked him to keep it quiet, that he had provided good intel to them. You're afraid of the lashback from the public or from other people. I mean, I knew another guy who was a remote viewer who had been in military intelligence. He worked with a DA's office down in Southern California. And the way they did it, they actually were targeting some narcotics deals and some big dealings. And he was able to pinpoint when and where some deals were going down. But rather than simply ordering the police to go, what they did was have this guy go out to a payphone back when there were payphones and phone in an anonymous tip that he saw some unusual activity at such and such an address. And he thought it had to do with drugs, never gave his name. And apparently, you know, they could act on an anonymous tip, but they couldn't act on a psychic tip.
Huh. That's a clever way of working around it.
Yeah. Yeah, it worked out really well. They had a great arrest record because of that.
Again, on the subject of remote viewing, in Dreaming Your Way Out of Your Body, you describe the out-of-body experience and the time it happened to you. Would you mind telling me that story or telling our listeners that story and whether or not you've had similar experiences since?
Sure. Well, first, the out-of-body experience is different than remote viewing in the same way that watching TV is different than actually going there, the location. The concept of remote out-of-body is that some part of you leaves your body. First of all, I should mention that I was teaching adult ed courses in parapsychology besides working at the ASPR. And I got to know a few people in my class. I got to be friends with people in my classes, including a woman who was a psychic. Her daughters, one of whom was very psychic as well. One was 18, one was 26. They lived about 50 miles from me, from where I was living. So I went to sleep one night, and the next morning remembered a dream that I had left my body and in my friend's house, my friend Denise's house. Now, she and her daughter were late night people, so they stayed up till 4 in the morning. And this apparently was somewhere around 2 in the morning that I appeared in the bedroom where they were both fully clothed and watching TV. And they saw me appear, and Denise started asking me questions and said I looked a little sleepy and I must be sleeping. We had this whole conversation. The dog apparently recognized me, the whole thing. And that's all I remembered from the dream. But a couple days later, I get a call at the ASPR, and Denise said, "Were you ever going to call me?" And I said, "About what?" And she said, "About the dream you had because you were here." And she described the conversation, and it was pretty much my dream. So a few weeks later, probably a couple weeks later, I was at a friend's bachelor party, and it was, this is the early 80s, and it was a very, very much a stag party. A lot of guys were watching a porno film, and to me, that just was kind of boring, sitting around with a bunch of guys doing that.
That has always seemed strange to me,
Went to the kitchen, made myself a drink, and as I'm standing there, I was so incredibly bored, frankly, that I suddenly felt like I was being pulled apart and saw myself in two places at once. I still felt I was in the kitchen, but I also felt that I was in Danita's living room, and she looked up from her book and said, "So what's going on?" We had this conversation, and the last thing I said to her was, "Write it all down, because I want to compare notes." And I was fairly conscious of this whole thing. So I felt myself coming back. I scrounged the kitchen, my friend's kitchen, for paper and something to write with, wrote it all down, and the next day I called her, and the first thing out of her mouth was, did you take notes? Did you write it all down? And so we compared notes, and it was the same conversation. Since then, no out-of-body experiences that I remember.
It seems to be tied to, I don't know what it seems to be tied to, but certainly you haven't been that bored since. Although, you know, that's particular situation.
A lot of my psychic experiences over the years have been tied to being bored. And actually, I tend to think that I've had a range of experiences, not necessarily anything consistent, because part of me wanted me to really understand what each of these kinds of experiences was.
Right. Do you think the sort of the growing prominence of digital devices is fragmenting attention and maybe hurting the chances of these kinds of things happening? Do you think that's in any way affecting the frequency of occurrence of psychic episodes or experiences?
Well, I wouldn't think that they would affect the frequency of any sort of psychic dreams, because, of course, you're not, hopefully not, texting in the middle of the night doing sleep texting or something like that.
Right, but more out-of-body experiences, I guess, in situations such as you've described.
Yeah, I think that conscious out-of-body experiences, except for the people who are perhaps interested in that. And definitely, I think having all these devices, and we're flooded with so much information today compared to 20, 30 years ago, that our attention definitely is fragmented. There's no question about it. I mean, we certainly didn't need laws 30 years ago for distracted drivers for things. And we still had radios and cassette players, and, you know, we had to eat in our cars and things. It just, there's so much more pulling at our attention today. I mean, I can't understand sometimes how kids can focus on anything. You know, forget ADHD. How can they focus on anything when they're being bombarded from all angles at all times with multi-devices? So I think it is going to impact some of the conscious psychic experiences, unless what happens is all this leads to more interconnectedness, because technically the internet itself is connecting us in ways that we've never been connected before. And it very well may be that we go towards connecting with people in a different way or more frequently psychically because we feel like we need to have that connection. So it could actually go in that direction also.
I guess we'll just have to see.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, just for fun, I see on your website you're a professional chocolatier.
Yep.
I got to say, I'm curious. How did that come about?
Well, I'm a food guy and a wine guy. And when chocolate started getting good, back in the late 90s, that was because of Scharfenberger Chocolate, actually, here in the Bay Area. They actually, I think in some respects, are responsible for the artisan chocolate movement. I got very interested in that and how chocolate was made and such. And through the early 2000s, I started really researching and reading because, again, I'm a food guy. One of my publishers was also into chocolate, and I sat her down. We had a chocolate tasting that I ran. She told me that she suggested that I write a book eventually about this. And I started interviewing some chocolate makers. I've been doing guided chocolate tasting presentations. I actually did one for the Monroe Institute last year. Just take kind of like a wine tasting, but with chocolate, which is a lot of fun for me. And I've combined it also with some of my other, talking about ghosts and things as well.
Right.
But one of the chocolate makers suggested that I actually take a course in how to make chocolate, just to kind of complete my understanding. And I did, and I really enjoyed it. And so consequently, since 2010, I have occasionally been making a few different products. Right now, I'm pretty much only doing special orders, but I'll be putting the menu up for that very soon on the Haunted by Chocolate website.
That is very cool. I've never met a chocolatier, so I was very curious. So
it's fun. Believe me, a lot more people want to talk about chocolate than want to talk about the paranormal.
You know, I that doesn't surprise me. So we're gonna wrap it up here. I wonder if you could just tell us again about the courses you have coming up.
Sure. So starting on the week of May 10th, that's next week, there is an Introduction to Parapsychology 8-week online course, which you can take for grade or just for fun through the Rhine Research Center, and it's rhine.org, and just go to the education link, and you'll see that course and a couple others, one of which is actually a course generally about dreams by my colleague Ryan Hurd. I'm also starting on the 18th, a 4-week course, which you can take kind of like a podcast. It's an audio-based course. You can either attend by phone. If you're here in the San Francisco Bay Area, then you can attend live. It is an investigations course. So it's ghost hunting, how to investigate the paranormal. So it's kind of to up your game. Even if you are already a ghost hunter, you can learn how parapsychologists have been doing it, what we've actually learned over the last 100 or so years, which is a little different than what the ghost hunting TV shows. There'll be a psychic development course as part of the 5 pillars of Jediism training that's going to be going up soon on the Church of Jediism's website, which launches on May the 4th. I'm a big part of that launch, and we're looking forward to being part of that. There's also a book coming out in November by the founder called Become the Force. So my website, just so you know, is mindreader.com, but it is down at the moment. Probably the best thing to find out on things I'm doing is through Facebook. On my author page, it's lloyd.auerbach.author. Please, if you go to my main page, if you find my page, please don't try to friend me. I'm at 5,000 limit. So go to my author page instead. Twitter, @profparanormal. That's P-R-O-F, paranormal. And you can find me in a few other places on the web. Certainly, I have a page that'll be on the Church of Jediism site, becometheforce.com. You'll see the faculty will be listed there as of this Thursday.
All right, the book is Psychic Dreaming, Dreamworking Reincarnation, Out-of-Body Experiences, and Clairvoyance by Lloyd Auerbach. Lloyd, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Welcome back. Thanks to Lloyd for coming on our show.
That was great. Funny enough, I met another author at an event on the weekend.
Right.
It was actually Barbara Smith, author of many, many great BC ghost books.
She's amazing. Not just BC, all over Canada.
Of course, pardon me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mentioned that we were having Lloyd on the show, and she seemed surprised.
Really?
Yeah. So apparently we're pretty small time for a guy like Lloyd. So I'm really appreciative of the fact that he took time out of his day to actually waste half an hour on us.
That was very kind of him.
I'm sure he was, looking at the email and going, the who? Yeah. The ghost story gays? No, that's not right.
Well, we have a good title and a good logo. So that counts.
So true.
In
so
this
true.
Business, that's what? 75% of the
absolutely.
Right there?
And you've got my golden personality ringing out over the air.
Yeah, that's what we have. That's a real asset.
Have this
anyway.
I need this.
Back to the book.
Right. Yes. we were talking during the break about the section on out-of-body experiences, which you found, you said you found particularly interesting.
I did. Part of it caught me off guard because he uses the term OBE, which in England, where I'm from, an OBE is an Order of the British Empire, usually reserved to be given to aging authors and starlets who are well past their prime.
So you must be in line for that pretty soon.
Yeah, that's funny. But he's talking about out-of-body experiences, and he actually put in, which is unusual for authors of this kind, he put in his own experience, and I just was going to read it real quick and tell you about it.
Sure.
He says, I've had my own experience with this as well, which ties into dreams and OBEs. Back when I was teaching a course on parapsychology, I became friends with one of my students who claimed a real psychic ability. One morning, I woke up having had a very vivid dream of being at their house, which was about 40 miles away. In the dream, it was late at night, and I was talking with her and her daughter. A couple of days later, the same friend slash student asked me if I had a dream about visiting her house on that night in question, the night I actually had the dream. When I replied yes, which with a bit of puzzlement, she said that I'd actually shown up there at her house after midnight while she was having a conversation with her daughter. I was seen and even somehow touched by them, and their dog reacted to me as well. At the time, I was also home asleep, unless I'd started sleep driving. They were aware I was home asleep because I apparently had told them, and they asked me to leave. I promptly vanished, she said. So that's kind of weird and interesting that they both have this recollection of this event taking place, but it all happened while Lloyd was actually sleeping.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. That's because it's a veridical experience.
Right.
Oh. But she verified it as well.
Yes.
I mean. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Now, didn't you have some kind of, you did something with remote viewing or something like that, out of body?
Well, sort of. I never went out of body, which is probably a good thing because I sleep naked.
And so we're all grateful.
And I just wonder how that would go. Because, like, do you get some kind of sleep jumpsuit? Or do you just go wearing whatever you're wearing?
like in all the movies where they are condemned to wear the outfit they died in?
Yeah, 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 right? Okay, so if I ever have a heart attack in my sleep, it's going to be a cold, chilly afterlife.
Unpleasant for everyone else.
But I have experimented a little bit with remote viewing, and it was actually the section in the book shortly after the OBE on bilocation.
Okay.
About being in two places at once astrally.
Oh.
That I found interesting because in 2015, I went down to New Orleans for the International Remote Viewing Association conference because I had heard about them on the, I believe it was on the Grimerica and Mysterious Universe podcast.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I had some time off and some spare cash. So I went down to New Orleans to this conference, and they talked a lot about, or not talked a lot, but the subject of bilocation came up, where you physically feel as though you are in two places. So you're aware of your senses here,
right?
But you're also very aware of this other, you're also in this other place.
And how do you get to the other place?
Well, I don't understand the mechanism.
Okay.
The interesting thing about remote viewing is, of course, when you go to the event, it's very much an accepted thing that it works.
Oh,
no one ever questions
it. Yeah,
you know, it's a given.
Like going to church.
It's exactly like going to church. Although I should say I tried remote viewing and it worked, which is much more than I can say for any of my church experiences.
Maybe you were doing it wrong. Not enough faith.
Father said I was doing it right.
Oh, okay. Let's keep moving.
I'd probably take that out.
No, I wouldn't. I don't think we're big with the Catholic Church.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I've been watching The Young Pope. Speaking of the Catholic Church, I've been watching The Young Pope on HBO. What a great show.
Really?
Oh, man. Yeah, Jude Law plays an American who somehow manages to end up as the youngest pope in history.
Cool.
It's a good show. Yeah, you should totally check it out. Yeah. It's not at all related to what we're talking about now.
No, okay. Anyway.
Moving back to remote viewing and bilocation. I went there and I listened to these people talk about it, and I thought, well, this sounds very interesting, but I didn't understand the mechanism. So I thought I tried an experiment. And the first time I tried it, actually, was because of John Herlovsky, who wrote The Sorcerer's – I think it's called The Sorcerer's Apprentice – about his time working under David Morehouse, who was part of the CIA's Project Stargate program,
okay,
which is the program that was remote viewing. I mean, right. Because remote viewing was a government program for about 20, 25 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. It was first operated, I think, by the Defense Intelligence Agency, and then it kind of bounced around. It was DOD at one point. Finally, in the mid-90s, it ended up at the CIA, and that's where it was killed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but it was called Project Stargate when it was finally terminated. Anyways, he gave an exercise, which is apparently a pretty common exercise with remote viewing. What they do is they give you a four-digit code. The code is just four random numbers. They have no connection to anything. And it is intentioned by the person setting the target being the place you're meant to be remote viewing.
Right.
So Herlovsky described the process as follows. You sit down somewhere quiet with a pad of paper and a pen and close your eyes. Put pen to paper, focus on the four numbers, and just let yourself drift and start recording your impressions. Now, there are more detailed ways to do this, and I did a lot of reading, and there are things about seeing the vortex, and the vortex takes you places, and, right. and all this magic school bus shit. I never got anywhere that stuff.
Take the little blue pill.
Exactly. I think that was the red pill.
Oh.
Little blue pill is something to which I do not wish to be privy. Keep it on that side of the table. Yeah, so I did this. He gave a four-digit code. I closed my eyes, and I started just letting my hand move, and I was recording impressions. Now, I didn't really see anything in my mind's eye, but I would get like shapes in darkness, if that makes sense. Like like those you know, those pin things you push your hand up to.
And yeah.
So like that, but all black.
Right.
So I saw this wide open space. I saw a football, what I thought was a football field. It was a sports stadium of some kind. I could hear people cheering. There was a tall structure, a bridge behind it, a wide open space in front of it. Now, this was 2015, and all that year I had LA on the brain.
Right.
I always wanted to go there. I kept thinking about going there. So I thought, well, the wide open space is the desert. The stadium is a Staples Center. I'm just thinking about LA. It's bullshit. And I put the paper away.
Right.
Then Herlowski came back on a couple weeks later and gave the answer to what the target had been. And it was the Eiffel Tower. And I thought, no, it definitely wasn't the Eiffel Tower. Horseshit.
Right.
But about a week later, I thought, I wonder if maybe the Eiffel Tower, you know, I went and had a look at it on Google Earth. And sure enough, if you look at it from a sort of a three-quarter angle to the side, there's a sports stadium right behind it, or right next to it, a bridge right behind it, and there's a wide open space in front of it.
So you, let me get this straight. So you did remote viewing and you turned the wrong way?
Yes.
That's awesome.
Or I turned the right way for me.
Yeah, that's it.
We'll go with that.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
So I was looking at, I was just seeing the location slightly off to the side, and I thought, well, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
And sure, you could say that this was, you know, there are any number of places where you could draw those things together, but it was a number of points, and I feel reasonably secure in that.
Yeah.
So I tried a few experiments with a friend of mine. I would put these cards in an envelope. I'd write a bunch of locations on cards.
Right.
Put them in an envelope and have the person shuffle the cards, pull one out, and they'd give me a four-digit code, and I would try and do it.
And
it worked.
Really?
Yeah. Now, the only thing is, because I had written the cards,
you knew what some of the numbers were going to be.
No, I didn't know the numbers, but I knew what some of the cards were going to be.
Right.
So, for example, one of them was Olympus Mons on Mars.
Right.
And immediately I said, it's cold, you know, but it's hot, and I'm looking down, and I see. But I knew right away, just something popped in my head, and went, Olympus Mons. So I don't know if I could just, because maybe there's something marking the paper, I knew which one it was. Right. And so I was then filling in the blanks.
Right. Yeah.
But an interesting case of bilocation, which is not exactly bilocation, but it's my show. So what are you going to do? Fight me, bro.
And I'm good.
But I had written on this thing, Tranquility Base.
Yeah.
And so my friend pulled the card out. And immediately in my head, I heard that famous transmission, this is Tranquility Base here.
Oh, wow.
But then I started seeing, it went away, and I started seeing these weird street lamps. And I thought, well, I mean, this isn't Doc Savage. There are no street lamps on the moon.
Yeah.
Disappointingly. I thought, well, I didn't get it. And so I told him, I said, I just don't know. I said, it was Tranquility Base. And then I started getting these weird street lamps. And they said, well, I pulled the card out, and I thought that maybe you were somehow picking up on, because of something on the back of these cards, on what you'd written.
Yeah.
So I changed it to Port Angeles, Washington.
No.
And Port Angeles has those kind of weird street lights.
Wow.
So it's...
That's kind of cool.
It's very cool, yeah. So I don't know how it works. You know, they still have not identified the mechanism. And of course, mainstream science refuses to admit that the mechanism exists.
Right, yeah.
And I mean, it's fair enough because it's hard to believe.
Yeah.
And we cannot identify how it works. But the project started before it was closed by the, I think it was a defense subcommittee.
Okay.
Basically had done thousands of these things.
Right.
And their results were statistically better than chance.
Wow.
But
that's really neat. I've never even heard of it.
When they evaluated the project, when the government evaluated the project, they cherry picked about 200 or 300 cases, something like that.
Right.
And said, well, this is not statistically
significant. So someone wanted to kill it.
Oh, absolutely.
That's where it went, yeah.
Joe McMonagle, who is one of the original or close to original Stargate viewers,
yeah.
He actually said he was told by one of these guys on committee that you are doing witchcraft.
Oh, wow.
And you will burn in hell.
So they thought it was going to get them in trouble. The government thought it would get them in trouble eventually.
No, I think what happened was the people running the defense community at that time were heavily evangelical.
Oh.
And so they thought they were quite literally being deceived by devils.
Yeah, as one is in the 1600s.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, the year 1995 by way of 1600. So, the project was killed.
Oh,
and
that's too bad.
Yeah, the committee is still around, and some of these people are actually used by police to find bodies.
Hmm.
And it was a really fascinating time. And again, it was just like that and so many other things in Lloyd's book. You're just struck by how little we know about the brain.
Well, yeah, and I liked reading the book. It was certainly interesting. I have never had a precognitive dream. I don't think I've ever had an out-of-body dream. One thing I have found that I can do, which is weird, is interpret dreams.
Really?
Yeah, and I've done that since I was a teenager. And people would tell me dreams, and I would very quickly and very clearly know what it was about, not in a psychological way, more in what was going on in their life or even what would happen to them.
Really?
Yeah. When I was in my 20s, a woman came to me and told me a dream, and she was in her 30s at the time. And I knew her greatest wish ultimately was to be married.
Right.
But,
sucker.
Yeah. But the dream she told me, I could very clearly see, like crystal clear, that was never going to happen.
Oh.
And
that's a bummer.
Yeah. And it was the one and only time I've ever fudged the answer back. And
really?
I said it had more to do with the guy she was currently interested in.
Right.
And I didn't tell her because what good would that do?
I guess.
And I thought, no, this isn't right. And she's now in her mid-50s and has still not had any kind of long-term
Jeez.
Relationship. But yeah. Other than that, though, you know, if you got a dream for me, let me know. I'll give it a shot.
You keep telling me not to do that.
Well, I don't want to hear your dreams. They're horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, you were telling me that you sent your publicist, Tori, the Predator.
Yes,
sent,
the Predator.
Who I can't wait to meet.
Tori is so sweet.
She sent the episode where I interview you to one of the reps for your book.
Yes.
And they were shocked.
They were legitimately concerned that you had called her the Predator.
Not only that, but they were shocked by some of the other humor, particularly the one about me and Barb on the bearskin rug.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm used to it from you now, so it doesn't really shock me. It's like people who work in a slaughterhouse, they just become immune to blood and death. But yeah, I guess for outside people who still have sensitivities.
Sometimes I forget other people hear these things.
That explains a lot.
Right?
Right?
I remember I was listening to, might have been the Paranormal Podcast a while back, and they had a fellow on who interpreted dreams. And I really felt for the guy because no one ever calls in with interesting dreams.
Right.
There was one woman who called in with the most prosaic brain dead dream. She said, my husband's job recently forced us to move and I keep having move to Egypt.
Right.
And I keep having dreams about being in a car that's moving too fast and I have no control over and I can't slow it down. And
it's on.
Right. I mean, come on.
She just interpreted her own dreams.
Yeah. Right. It. Just hang up the phone
and shoot yourself. Oh no. Sorry.
Well, I'm glad you said it. This nice break. But yeah. Right. Shut up. You know what this means.
Yeah.
You want us to tell you that your life doesn't suck? Well, I hate to break it to you, sweetheart.
Yeah.
It does.
You're moving to Egypt.
Yep,
it's not going to be easy for you.
I've been there. You couldn't pay me to live there.
No.
No. I mean, the people were fairly nice. I mean, we weren't robbed there. We were robbed in Morocco.
Oh, perfect.
Twice. I'm going to go on record and say, Morocco.
Oh, now you've alienated all our Moroccan listeners.
Thankfully, there are none.
Nah, I know.
Because
they're
too busy robbing tourists. Oof, man, Morocco. I got a stomach parasite in Morocco.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. My cousin ended up in an Egyptian hospital because of Morocco.
Oh, that's not good.
So
Morocco, no.
Morocco, you're on blast.
It's on the no
You suck.
List.
What in God's name was I talking about?
No one ever knows.
Oh, man. Right. Dreams, interpreting dreams.
Yes.
Right. I tend to have very, very bizarre dreams, you know? And well, I shouldn't say that. I have very annoying prosaic dreams, and then I have very bizarre dreams.
Right.
And I have actually had a handful of what I guess you could call precognitive dreams.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, I don't know why or how it all makes any sense, but I think there's a trio, maybe four dreams. They're all kind of a piece that happened years apart, but all sort of fit together like some kind of jigsaw puzzle. But I don't know what that puzzle says or what it means.
Right.
So the first one happened years ago. I was in the dream. I was on a train. That train is going through an industrial town somewhere.
Okay.
I fall off the train and I don't know where I am. I'm wandering around this industrial area. There's some big steel building. But eventually night comes and something starts chasing me through this industrial yard.
Yeah.
The last thing I remember seeing before I woke up was a white office door going into the office of one of these industrial spots with a little window in the middle with the reinforced glass.
Yep.
And there was a naked bulb above the door.
Right.
I was just about to go inside. I woke up. The next thing I remember is I heard the word Edgley in my head.
Okay.
So I Google Edgley a while later, and it's actually a small town in Pennsylvania on the railroad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I at the time, I looked it up on Google Street View, and believe it or not, the entire area along the train tracks was fogged out on Google Street View.
No.
It was.
Oh, weird.
So I always said to myself, oh, I'm going to go to Edgley. I'm going to make a point of going there.
As one does about Edgley.
Yeah. When you have a weird dream calling you to a place where you're being chased by a monster, you should go to that place.
No, you should not go to that place because that's where you'll meet certain death. Have you not watched any movies?
I watched a lot of them, but I sleep a lot.
Oh, okay.
Man, this would have saved me a lot of trouble.
Should have talked to me first.
I've been to all three of these places.
Wow.
And I did end up going there. And back in 2014, I helped a friend move from Austin, Texas to Boston, Massachusetts.
Right.
And we went through Pennsylvania. Went through Edgley. And now Edgley is just a little suburb across the highway from Bristol, Pennsylvania, but it's right on the river. There's a huge bridge. And what's interesting about that is another dream I had was I was sitting in a small home. I was looking at a man standing in the doorway. It was like I was his wife.
Okay.
And there was the paneling was all wainscoting, I know. And I was telling him to pick up batteries
right
on the way back from his jog. And so he runs out of the house and jogging. Now, my point of view shifted to following him as he jogged.
Right.
And I heard Peter Gabriel's Salisbury Hill.
Okay.
I didn't even know the name of it at the time. I actually had to Google the lyrics when I woke up.
Right.
But as he's jogging away from the house, I saw this wide river with a big bridge. And now when I got to Edgley, it wasn't exactly the same, but it was very close. The next dream I had was about I used to have this actually series of dreams about going to a school.
Okay.
That school it was made of brick. Now, of course, I'm where I'm from, we don't have brick schools.
No, it's all wood, right?
Yeah. But it was a brick schoolhouse, and in the back, there was a courtyard hemmed in on three sides by the school.
Right.
The courtyard had, in the dream, they would have hopscotch and basketball hoop. And I didn't know anywhere that looked like this.
Yeah.
Until one day, I was watching a news report on Maryland, and I saw brick buildings. And I thought, oh, I bet it's an East Coast place. Didn't think much more about it than that. Until on that same trip where I went to Edgley, we went to go check out Centralia, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Centralia, Pennsylvania.
Yes, of course, the one with the underground fires.
Yeah, it's been burning underneath it for 50 years. While leaving Centralia, which I don't recommend anyone go to, just let that poor place die.
Right.
We went under this overpass, and all of a sudden, I was seized with this feeling where I should turn right.
Okay.
So I hung a right, went up a small hill, and what's standing there but a brick schoolhouse? So I parked the car. I said to my friend, hold on. Went all the way around back, and there's a courtyard surrounded on three sides by the school.
Oh, wow.
And it didn't look like my dream, but it was there. And I thought, well, that's coincidental. I went and looked at the front of the school, and it says established 2000. I thought, well, that's obviously not right.
Right.
However, I just found out 2 days ago, I had some spare time. I went looking through Google.
Right.
That school was built in 1929. Oh. And has been renovated and rebuilt over the course of years. But that original building had a courtyard in the middle and was surrounded on three sides
by
the school.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
That's wild.
So then the third dream I had, which turned out to be accurate, was, again, several years ago, before I had any interest in ghosts, it was about a haunted river. Right. And in the dream, there's a river where people can hear the sounds of battle, and they would find sometimes these musket balls in the grass.
Yeah.
And the river was kind of like a really windy river. with lots of green around it. And again, the dream kind of went on from there, but I sort of always remembered the river. Now, last year I helped the same friend move from New York City to Oakland.
Yeah.
And my job on these trips is to find the place, spooky places to eat. He finds food.
Right.
I find spooky places
right.
to hang out.
Right.
And so I thought, wow, haunted river. Oh, geez, I wonder if there's any place, because I want to go check out Gettysburg.
Right.
And then I thought, well, let's check out haunted rivers. So I Google haunted rivers, Pennsylvania, because we'd be driving through Pennsylvania. And sure enough, there's this stretch of the Brandywine River where, along Route 100 where the Battle of Chad's Ford took place. And according to some people who live in the area, you can still hear the battle happening.
I've heard of that, yeah.
And sometimes you see soldiers marching along the side of the road.
Wow.
So we stayed the night in Westchester, which is nearby to Chad's Ford, because Chad's Ford was expensive. And we drove that road at about 3 a.m. Nothing. It was spooky, but nothing.
Yeah.
So the next morning we were just about to leave, and I said to my friend, do you mind if we drive that road again in the daytime? And he said, yeah, sure. I don't care. So he drove. I sat in the passenger seat, and all of a sudden I felt this kinship with the place. Like I knew it somehow.
Right.
And of course it didn't make any sense because I'd never been there before. And so at one point I asked my friend if we could pull over by the side of the road. We did. Now I couldn't see the river because it was behind a fence and then behind some trees.
Mm-hmm.
But as I stood there next to the fence, looking onto the forest behind which was the river, I had this strange sensation, and completely unbidden, I heard this voice say in my head, well, boys, I'm back. And I thought, where'd that come from? So, and I said to myself, why didn't I recognize this in the daytime or at night? And then again, same voice, because we weren't here at night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we got in the car. My friend wanted to go to I think it's Andrew Wyeth. He's a painter.
Right.
Who's famous for being from that area.
Yeah.
So we went to his studio. There's an art museum there. And as we got there, the museum is right on the Brandywine. And there's a bunch of kids there. That's where they sell tickets for kids to go tubing. They tube down the river.
Right.
And again, we parked the car and I'm watching these kids go with and bring their tubes to the side of the river. And this voice popped up in my head again and said, we bled in that river so they could fucking play on it.
Wow.
And another voice kind of popped in and said, yeah, but that was the whole point.
Oh, wow.
And it just, I don't know, I just felt complete in this weird way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really wanted to walk the bank of the river, but we, after doing the museum, we didn't have time.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to boogie. But I would love to go back there. And it's just these three seemingly unconnected dreams that all connected to a place I had never been before or even really thought about.
That you knew.
Yeah.
Cool.
So go figure.
Yeah. No, that's awesome.
Now let's talk about the other dream I had about those two Russian girls.
Okay. No. We're done. We're good.
You said you'd interpret my dreams.
No, I'm not interpreting those, you pig.
Killjoy. All right. So that's going to wrap it up for us tonight. As always, thank you for tuning in.
Mm-hmm.
We hit a milestone last week. We have had 2,000 total downloads for 7 episodes so far.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm no podcastologist, but that seems like pretty good numbers for a couple of bozos on a new show.
Yeah. No. And even more amazing than that is the range of places where people are downloading. I couldn't believe that.
Oh, I know. It was crazy. Yeah. The service we use tracks locations. And we are worldwide, man. Us and Pitbull.
Yeah. That wasn't funny 5 years ago when Pitbull was relevant.
How do you even know who that is?
Because I'm hip. I listen to FM radio.
You fell asleep in the rest home, in front of the rest home television after someone's grandson had come visit?
No, I read Billboard on my screen while you're talking.
Oh, okay.
You brought that on yourself, yeah. Mr. Never Read a Book.
I guess I did. Anyways, we thought we'd take a minute to say hi to those people listening to us across the world just because, hey, that seems pretty cool to me.
Absolutely.
So, hello, Belfast. Beautiful city. I saw Down play there at the university back in 2008. Phil Anselmo was very drunk. No one would give him weed. It was really funny.
Hello, Moscow. I'm guessing that must be Peter, who does the music for our show and his friends.
I can only imagine. Hello, Los Angeles. I love you, too, and I hope to get back there soon. You just got to fix that whole president thing.
Hi, Portland. Keep on keeping it weird. We love your donuts.
Well, if I could still eat donuts, I would.
Well, I love the donuts.
Isn't that nice for you?
It is.
I like the strip clubs where you can get food. I think that's neat.
Just keep going.
Okay. Assalamu alaikum, Dubai. I don't know why in God's name anyone in Dubai is listening to us, but we're sure happy you are.
Well, there's a number of them, so bless their hearts.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello, Buffalo, Missouri. We all know that's the real home of the Buffalo Chicken Wing.
Hello, Levin, Arizona, where the town motto is, we're pretty close to Phoenix.
Hello, Evesham, UK. You probably all drink tea. I wouldn't know because I don't know anything about you.
We can fix that, though. Call me.
Your wife still doesn't listen to the podcast, does she?
No, she does not. finally, there's a lot more, but we're going to wrap it up here. But we want to say hello to Kamloops, Canada, home to my cousin and long-suffering travel companion, Mike, along with the Drunk in a Graveyard crew, who you should check out at drunkinagraveyard.com. So don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes, share us with your friends. Mm-hmm. Think of this podcast as an open relationship without the possibility of angry recrimination. Big thanks, of course, to Lloyd Auerbach for taking the time to chat with us. His book, Psychic Dreaming, can be found wherever fine books are sold.
Our intro was composed and performed by Pizzanto Music, and our bumper music was written and performed by Will Forbes Music. You can find both of those fine fellows on SoundCloud via the link in our show notes.
And Will, we really hope to be able to pay you soon.
Yes.
I mean, he's been really good about letting us use his music literally for nothing, but we do eventually want to pay him money.
Once we are making some money.
That would be nice.
That would be nice.
If you're in the greater Victoria area, don't forget to come check out Ian's book signing at Bolin Books at the Hillside Mall on Tuesday, May 9th at 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. You can buy a book, listen to a reading, and watch me and his publicist engage in mortal combat as she tries to take my skull back to her home planet as a trophy.
Tori is not going to be taking anyone's skull.
You say that now. All right, folks. Like I said, we'll be back in 2 weeks. So until then, take care and be good to one another. I was having an out-of-body experience, Your Honor. That's why I was in that locker room. Well, I'm about to have an in-my-body experience in prison.
Yeah, exactly. Make new friends.
That's right. I'm going to cut that out.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.